Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone, welcome to Be Good and Kato. Should we put this episode on the Be Good and Rewatch It feed and be like, hey, this doesn't exist anymore?
but
you want to go to this other, because someone's got to
come over here.
Someone did unsub, right? Like sometimes you don't, like a podcast stops and you don't unsub from it. You just
I'll pull up Pocket Casts right now. I'll show you that little fucking icon in my phone. I'm someone.
Exactly.
You
know
people are still listening to that podcast. Not in large numbers, but like every once in a while, I'll peek over there and be like, 100 people decided to download and listen to one of those podcasts this week. Interesting.
All right, so strategically, this is the smart move. Great. Yeah. All right, marketing meeting over. Clap onto the podcast. Podcast called My Turn. It's sort of like a new movie podcast, kind of formalizing a new way of sort of doing movie conversations. We're doing a really good job about talking about Michael Mann films, like no notes, like cruising right with Robert. We halfway through.
Wow, did you say we're cruising through it on the eve of us recording our Collateral podcast? What a fantastic play on words. Thank you, Patrick. I didn't realize you were such a fan.
Well, that is like the one of the few Michael Mann films I have seen before I saw The Keep. So that's true. I didn't understand the synergy, but, you know, look, here it is nonetheless. We sort of had struggled to get like a regular cadence on like the you know, Manhunting makes sense. You're going through the Michael Mann films, and we wanted to get on more sort of a regular schedule, kind of like cadence with talking about movies. So my turn, the concept is one person picks a movie to start with, and then they kind of host that podcast, that conversation, and then we rotate. And the next movie has to be related in some way. It doesn't have to be a sequel. It could like share an actor or a theme or a genre. Like the idea is that like the next person kind of like picks the next conversation, and it's sort of like thematically in conversation somehow, some way with the previous movie. Now, I just said it didn't have to be a sequel, and the whole setup for this first turn of the wheel will be Predator to Prey, but that is because I really wanted to talk about Prey and just shoehorned a concept into it, and then kind of stumbled into this as a broader concept.
We also felt you couldn't really talk about Prey without at least like making sure we all had the Predator frame of reference.
It was suggested by Kato that maybe we should flip them around, but I think it will become... I think it would be interesting to do it the other way, but I think it'll be abundantly clear upon watching Prey why watching Predator first will make a lot of sense for a lot of reasons. And so after that, it'll turn to Ren and Kato. I don't know the exact order. We'll have to use some online website to randomize it. And then they'll pick a film. And at the end, you, the listeners, will also pick a film from like a pre-selected group. I'm hoping someone will pick Prometheus. I would love to yell about that messy movie, but that won't be my choice. That is just what's in my heart, and I will put it out there. One other note is that so these podcasts are going to start on the Waypoint Plus feed, but a week later they are going to show up on the main podcast feed. So the ones on the main podcast feed. I mean, do you want to hear me talk about UK broadband in the UK? Then, hey, you just stick to that Waypoint Radio feed. But if you want them without ads and you want everything in one place, your best bet is to sign up over at waypointplus.com. So we've all talked, but I haven't properly introduced everyone. I'm Patrick. That was Rob. Ren.
Howdy. Howdy and hello.
Kato.
Hello.
So we are here to talk about Predator 1987. I want to read the description on the back of the VHS tape that came out in 1988 as a way of explaining the premise of this film. Arnold Schwarzenegger stars in this action-packed adventure story of fighting men pitted against an unseen enemy. Fighting men. That's a very... a force more powerful than their fiercest weapons. Recruited by the CIA to rescue hostages held by guerrilla fighters in a Central American country.
Definitely not Nicaragua. Don't say Nicaragua. Don't look away.
I love the vagueness. I should look. I would be wild and interested to read the script and see like what sort of vagaries are we dealing with here? Schwarzenegger and his men encounter an enemy unimaginably more deadly than any on Earth because the Predator is not of this Earth. Packed with spectacular special effects and combat scenes of gut-wrenching power, Predator is the most terrifying and most exciting Schwarzenegger movie yet. So the reason I picked Predator was not like any like strong emotional ties to Predator as a movie. It's just that I watched Prey, thought that movie fucking ripped, and was like, let's watch Predator first so Prey will make more sense. But like upon revisiting this, like thinking about Predator, it's like a really interesting movie for like a lot of it reasons, even separate from like the thematics that we'll get into. It's the directorial debut of John McTiernan, who goes on to direct Die Hard, The Hunt for Red October, and also goes to jail for several years for lying to the FBI. Did not know that part. And then like the last major thing he did filmmaking wise was like a short film for a Ghost Recon game in 2017. Okay. Sure. Predator comes out in 1987. So this is like right as Schwarzenegger is ascending sort of as like an action movie star. It's 5 years after Conan the Barbarian, 2 years after Commando, and the same year as Running Man. It's the year before he makes his comedic sort of mark with Twins and like becomes an actor who is known more than just like for taking his shirt off and firing guns or walking slowly. And then it's a few years before 1991's Terminator 2. And interestingly, the only reason this movie exists is there was a joke going around Hollywood, I guess, that the screenwriters had heard at some sort of party that was, well, after Rocky IV, there's no one left for Rocky Balboa to fight, so I guess he'll have to fight an alien. And they thought that was a funny bit, and so they wrote an entire premise that became the script Predator based on hearing that joke.
Incredible.
And then also, was it Val... No, who is it? Vin... Oh, who was the who's the martial artist who became actor that was originally...
Van Damme?
I wrote down... Huh?
You talking about Van Damme?
Yes, Van Damme. I wrote down Vin Diesel in my notes, and I was like, that's not right. Yeah, Jean-Claude Van Damme was originally cast as the Predator when it was more of a ninja-like, agile role, but then he kept passing out on set and complaining that he was never going to have his real face on camera. And also, when they stacked them next to any of the actors in this film, they went, he's so small... No one will buy this. So all that is like why I think makes Predator like a really interesting film to revisit, especially so many years later. And I do want to hear everyone's origin stories related to this film, because I feel like people of a certain young men, boys of a certain age have specific relationship movies like Predator and Alien and things like that. But Ren, I have to know what you thought of Predator.
So my first note is that I agree with Blaine. I think if the main cast hadn't been a bunch of slack-jawed F-slurs, more of them would have lived. that's kind of my take. I think that they would have had an easier time. Predator existed in a very odd space in my mind because I had this friend growing up who had the worst undiagnosed ADHD of anyone I knew. And as someone who has extremely severe ADHD, that's saying something. But he was obsessed with Alien and Predator and would always like enact the Predator's violence, like in like role play. I remember one time I went over his house and he was playing Mortal Kombat and he was obsessed with playing Predator in Mortal Kombat. I think we watched Alien versus Predator at his house. I fell asleep in the middle of it. I have a disease. So that is like my pre this.
Are we talking about when Predator was a guest character in one of the Mortal Kombat games? Okay. Yes. All right. Wow. Okay.
That's my first exposure. And then seeing Alien versus Predator and immediately falling asleep, just conking out.
It's
seconds
a bad movie.
In.
It's a bad movie.
So that's my before seeing this film for this podcast experience with Predator. I think that this movie is really interesting. This is the first like action film I've like really re-engaged with, like, from this specific period of action movies. Mm-hmm. My first actually thought while watching it was, one, boy, they act like ammunition is a concept as opposed to a material reality in the world. But like, that's the thing. One of the things I found really fascinating about this is that like action movies from like the 2000s onward, when I'm growing up, really prize like efficiency in violence. It is like the John Wick style of, I am going to do as much violence as quickly as possible with as little like movement as necessary, versus this film where they are just like, you can put a bullet anywhere if you really try.
Well, and if it's a chain gun, you don't even have to think about it. It just does the work for you. Look at that thing spin.
Look at it go. And I think that's a really interesting school of action movie like making, where it's like, we just have big guys who look real big, and do they do things that you would associate with a big guy? Not really. Sometimes they lift heavy things, but the action is watching a big man move, as opposed to like literally choreographed fight scenes. And I find that like really interesting.
Rob, do you have a story of watching Predator for the first time?
Yeah, but so I also didn't get to this till later, in part because, like Ren, you alluded something there a moment ago about this being an action movie of a different mold, where it's all just like, watch big burly dudes just unload like weapons at the camera extensively. And that was, so remember when I'm growing up, that kind of action style is first, like, there's a million of those movies, and two, it's like really passe, and I couldn't distinguish that Predator was different from them. And so like the kids I hung out with who were like, man, I fucking love movies like this, made me skeptical of Predator, because these were also the people who were pushing you to be like, you know what we should do is we should watch like Commando. Hey, you ever seen you want to watch Full Metal Jacket for the 100th time? Hey, let's just watch the scenes where somebody says something racist, or the scenes where people are getting killed. Shit, yeah, like that. Yeah. And so like none of that made me feel like, oh, I want to watch Predator. I want to, like, this movie looks like it'll be interesting. So I skipped it for years, until years later. I was visiting a friend and he was like, we just decided, you know, we need the biggest bro down kind of night that we've had in years. It was like, both our partners were out. We were sort of alone. We were just sort of hanging out alone in their apartment for a couple days. And it was like, we just need to watch Predator. We just need, first we need to go on a beer run, and then we need to order like a small mountain of pizza, and then we need to watch Predator. And so we're like, all right, let's just turn off our fucking brains. Watch Predator. This is gonna be dumb as hell. It's gonna be awesome. And like 30 minutes later, like, he and I look at each other and we're like, this is transcendent. this is one of the most trenchant portraits of masculinity and like male intimacy we've ever seen. And so, mind you, we still got drunk, but we're also sitting there being like, this is not, despite it being one of those movies, it's like, there's a reason it spawns a bunch of imitators. But also there's a reason that, like, this is regarded as a classic, and the genre that it tended to inspire, like, just stocked the action rack of VHS rental stores for years. But Predator always sort of stood apart.
How about you, Kato?
I didn't see this at all for a very long time. My only, like, exposure to Predator was the Alien versus Predator arcade game, I believe.
Hell yeah, that was Capcom 2D beat 'em up.
Yeah,
that
game,
nice. So good.
There was my little league team always went to a specific pizza place, and that pizza place had an arcade in the back, and that's where that had that. So like, that was it, and I didn't know that there were movies connected to it at all. I was very like
Well, those games were aimed at an audience that were not necessarily, which is true of a lot of that period in which there would be, it was very frequent in the 80s and 90s for like action figures to be made of movies that kids had no business seeing.
Yeah. No, my parents were very, very strict. I've told this story before of how like I couldn't see things that were PG-13 until I literally turned 13. And so like there was no way I was going to ever see that under like the purview of my family, but it also like just didn't come up. I don't know what it is. It's something.
It's probably R.
This has to be R
because it's post Jaws, like, and that's where then you start getting more of this stuff.
There's nothing like R rated about the line "sexual Tyrannosaurus," and yet that is not a line that occurs in a PG-13 or lower film.
Did they squeeze in F slurs in PG-13 movies? Was that one of the ones that was considered mid? Okay.
Well, oh my God. Yes. And it's shocking to go back. It's one of those things that you sort of filter out, but except when you go back to revisit. I remember last summer, 2 summers ago, whenever the new Bill and Ted movie came out, I'd never seen the first two Bill and Ted movies, and I just cultural osmosis them. It's like, oh, I've definitely seen those. And then I watched a couple of YouTube clips of like extended scenes. Like, no. I know what death is. I know that they play the game. I was like, I could tell you the plots of both films, but had never actually seen them. And the movies are tremendous. Like I love both of them, but it's the second one, I believe, that like in one of the opening scenes just drops an F-bomb, and like they've apologized for it. Like as they made that third one and recognized like how wild it sounds, how totally out of character it sounds, even though it's not, because that's just what movies did at the time. I don't think it was as frequency as like a swear word, but it was, I think it'd be more common than you would suspect, even amongst films that you might think would be, I don't know, not necessarily better than that, but it's just it's not uncommon of films in the 80s for sure.
Yeah, I was totally unsurprised by its presence. I guess the thing that I didn't know was what tier of curse word the slur was considered before people were actively thinking about it as a slur. But it's good to know. So it's a PG-13 slur. Got it. I will keep this in mind versus one of the R-rated slurs.
And then
it's. Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, finish with that. Like, I didn't end up seeing Predator until like probably 5 years ago. Honestly, like for the first time after doing a small run of like, oh, gonna watch some alien films. Oh, right, that thing was connected somehow, right? I should go back and watch that. But only ever watched the first one. Never seen any of the sequels. And came away from it a little like, yeah, that was neat. Watching it this time though, I actually found it a lot more interesting. I think I was just in a different headspace back then about like watching especially action movies, and yeah, I think this one is actually a very interesting film from that era.
I was gonna say like the Alien versus Predator connection is really fascinating to me, because that's also where I like interact with Predator as a concept for the first time. But the thing that I find so interesting about it is that like the movies, despite the fact that like their cultural connection is these are the movies where the big fucked up aliens kill a bunch of people, like that is the space that they share in the culture, and that has like moved forward with like things like Alien versus Predator, right? But there are like really, really interesting thematic conversations happening between those two films that like no one has ever really mentioned to me before. Like Alien, I think, is pretty well established as like a film that is like really interested in gender politics and really interested in like gendered performance and like a bunch of things.
Yeah, Geiger liked to make everything look like, apparently there's a story, and maybe this is apocryphal, but the alien egg in Alien, I came across this while researching this podcast, originally looked even more explicitly like a vagina. And then one of the people on set was like, can we add a couple more lines? So, there's like a little bit of distance to that. Almost as though there was someone on set being like, we know you're horny and we know this is a part of your work, like some sort of like on-set Geiger consultant. That is like,
we're gonna need you to tone it down.
Yes, the alien opens his mouth and a dick does come out. Like, we understand that, but
yeah, I think that that combined with a film that is, as Rob put, about male intimacy and about like masculinity in really interesting ways, I was shocked and excited about the thematic connections between those two texts.
Okay, so here's my question. Here's where I'd like to begin. Yes, I agree. This movie is a really interesting character study of masculinity, machismo. It's a movie in which it spends so much time showing these masculine figures, like the quote peak of like the male form, and then the movie's ultimately solved by somebody being clever. How much is the movie, do we give it credit for being aware of that? Or is how much are we projecting that onto the film? At times I wonder that, yes, this reading of Predator is like this subversive work. Is that just a reading we've given to it? Or how much is the work aware that it's doing that as the movie is playing out?
I mean, for me, the thing is, this is part of a run of films about that very subject that McTiernan makes. Like, I mean, if you look at what McTiernan is going to do after this is Die Hard, which is also explicitly about male insecurity and a feeling of like dislocation in a changing society. Like, I think, I don't know if like when the concept was originally put on paper, that was like what they were making. But I do think it is the film that McTiernan shot and like the one that, like, I don't think. Well, you know, I'm sure we'll get to it, but like, if this isn't intentional, this is not what the film is about, then what the hell is the Bill Duke monologue to the moon, like memorializing Blaine doing in this picture? Like, it's like there are like all the little odd things that add up to some of the greatness of this film are all these little odd beats that suggest sort of a critical and outside perspective on the little like cloistered masculine world of these characters.
Yeah. I mean, like also the film's like the most distinctive frame from this movie that has become a widespread meme on the internet of Dylan and Butch fucking clasping hands, flexing as much as they can, is like, immediately establishes the relationship between those two characters as a relationship built on performances of masculinity. And then 30 minutes into the movie, that completely collapses and is revealed to be as hollow as it could be. And it totally shakes the foundation of Dutch and then like the character relationships going forward. And I think that you cannot do something like that without being like, I think there might be some, hey guys, I think we're saying something with this movie. So yeah, and also like, I don't know, I think that is what the text is, even if it's not intended.
I agree. I fully agree with that. I think it's just so interesting to consider how we look at these movies, like over the stretch of time, and how you look at these action movies as a genre, and then this one sticking out for that particular reason. Go ahead, Kato.
I was also gonna say, I feel like in a different, more on like on its face film, even the like the original premise is different, right? Like the original premise here of Schwarzenegger Dutch's team coming in is that it's a rescue mission, but it ends up not being that. And in a different film that is like more gung-ho about the stuff that it's portraying, they're just going in to fuck these people up, right? They're going in to get the Sandinistas, right? They're going in to get the commies.
The thing is like when Schwarzenegger says that, or Dutch says that line, I'm like, this is not what we do.
Right.
Like, yeah, but you really fucking good at it. And the last 20 minutes have been a pretty spectacular like a scene. It's showing that you're really good at it.
But I think this is one of the things that also makes this a really interesting post-Vietnam film, which is that like so much of this film is about warrior culture and warrior ethos. And one of the things, like, this movie opens on a deception, like that hand clasp itself is a lie, right? That like these are two like blood brothers forged in battle. But It turns out Carl Weathers is a snake, that the two men's paths diverge after Vietnam. The backstory is right. They were in, all these guys were in various forms of the shit during Vietnam. But like coming out of this experience, Schwarzenegger explicitly takes his team of like super warriors and says, the type of war we fought, the type of things we do, I'm ruling out for us. We will use our martial skills for rescue missions and such, but we are not murderers, we are not assassins, etc. Dylan has made the choice that he's doubled down. Starts working with CIA, and he goes all in on this notion of like black ops everything. Sometimes, you know, you just people's throats
just do what you gotta do to get the job done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so much of this like comes down to the fact that like Dutch and his men are basically tricked into waging a guerrilla strike on an insurgent camp, the type of thing they explicitly did not want to be involved with post Vietnam. And they're tricked by, you know, Weathers as this embodiment of the U.S. government. But also at issue here is that in some ways, Schwarzenegger is adhering to a very old warrior code. This notion of there needs to be something redeeming or admirable about battle, about how we use these skills. And this is kind of has a perverse mirror in the Predator itself, right? That in a lot of ways, like both they enter the jungle as the like super high tech, hyper competent guys who, when you come down to it, let's be real, are massacring a peasant army, essentially. And this is what they've been cutting their teeth on. This is what they do. And it gives them this false sense of confidence and prowess that is in a lot of ways just founded on material superiority to their adversaries. And the Predator is the mirror of that. Like, you know, they are now the under-equipped, unready force about to be massacred by a higher tech foe. But the same issue recurs, which is that the Predator is trying to operate according to some martial code. This entire thing is about trying to find like some idea of a worthy fight, a worthy way to use these skills. And that also ends up proving to be hollow here. And so I think this is one of the things that I really like find interesting about this film is a post-Vietnam film, which is this examination of like the relationship between the military, the idea of the warrior, and the role that technology plays in our conception of like competence and prowess.
Yeah. And I mean, the film over and over sort of strikes at sort of that hierarchy. There's the moment after they have the battle at the village where Carl Weathers' character is asked to turn around. And then, you know, there's a scorpion on his shoulder that he kind of gets stabbed. And like, there's a sequence where the Predator, shoots at like an animal that he thinks might be Dutch. And like a lot of this movie is sort of establishing like, well, to a different, you know, all along the chain, there is something that is going to treat you like an ant. And all of this shit that you've trained for, that you think makes you prepared, that makes you superior. Well, actually, it doesn't mean jack shit, like put in front of the right force. And that's what makes like a lot of the movie's themes like feel, I think it's part of like what makes it. There are action movies that are fun to watch. Like the experience you had, Rob, of there are movies I watch that are just movies to have some drinks with and go, damn, that looks cool. I like that design. I think part of what makes the Predator resonant still is whether it fully intended to or not, like the way it operates and comments on the aesthetic that it plays with, right? Like the fact that it has this sort of commentary right after it has in a sequence, that entire village sequence is just a bombastic it's well shot. Like it looks, you know, coolish, makes them all seem like deadly brute assassins, but like it feels tonally out of sync with like the commentary, but that's why it works because it does ultimately then feel out of sync with like the commentary it's doing about, you know, what these characters represent to one another, and more broadly in the genre.
Because I mean, I think. Oh, please, Kato.
I was just gonna say, because in a different film in the genre, that fight happens at the end. It is the final fight, and they come out victorious, right? Like yeah. It is the biggest, most bombastic kind of moment, like bombast in that way of just like the most explosions, like literally on screen at one time. Mm-hmm. But that happens, that's like 20 minutes in, like early. And you're like, yeah. Oh, shit.
This movie's surprisingly long. I was surprised it was, movies of this like kind of genre pieces are, let's barely skate to 90 minutes. And it's like an hour 47. But it gives it space to breathe, which is why it's allowed to do exactly what you're saying, Kato, where something becomes, especially upon rewatching, it's like, wow, this is really early in this film.
Well, because they're trying to. That's just setup, right? That is just setup for the inversion that happens when the predator, you know, finally starts interacting with this group of people.
Oh yeah, that's the thing I was going to wrap around to is the hollowness you were talking about, and like the thing about the code that I find interesting. Like the it isn't just that the code is hollow, right? Is that it's hollow, and it will get you killed. If you have a code, it will get you killed. If you have a code and it turns out to be hollow, that will also get you killed, which is one of the things I find interesting about this movie, right? The way that, Billy is like, just decides, I'm going to fight the Predator in ritual combat. And we don't even get to see that fight. He just gets murked off screen. And he's actually, I think, the only character who gets murked fully off screen of the main set, which I find interesting.
We see one of the characters dragged, like there are varying degrees. There's not a ton of like graphic depiction for as much like adjacent gore as they're in the mm-hmm. film. A lot of it is after the fact or in the shadows as opposed to on camera and sort of gratuitous. But you're right that I think Billy's death is the one that becomes the like off-screen scream.
Yeah, Mac gets fucking, oh my God.
Exploded onto the camera itself. Like,
yeah, truly. Mac gets frame 313. It's not good. It's a bad scene for him. And same goes for, Slurman.
Blaine. Yeah.
Blaine. Same option to Blaine. Poncho gets like jabbed. But yeah. I think it's interesting that Billy gets owned off screen, but then the final thing that the Predator gets his ass beat by a worthy foe, and instead of just taking his L, he's like, I'm gonna nuke myself. Get owned, asshole. And it reveals it to be hollow, and in doing so, quite literally kills him. And I find that aspect of the film interesting. But Rob, your question.
No, I was just sort of thinking about the pacing of this film overall. And I do think one reason this film stands up is like nobody knows what a Predator movie is yet. And so McTiernan invests a lot of time in this bait and switch of like, we're going to send these guys off on this like weird, like jungle rescue mission. And we all come to it knowing that like there's something else in that jungle.
It has a very thing like opening where we see the spaceship, mm-hmm. but nothing else. Like it's only the occasional, you know, the heat mapping that is telling us, well, there's something else going on, but otherwise, you know, hold on to your butts.
Yeah. And so like it has this really, I think something that works really well is the sort of onion-like layers of these guys realizing that they don't know what is going on, right? The fact that Dutch is increasingly starting to suspect that, like, there's just all these inconsistencies in Dylan's story about what's going on. There's the fact they come across all those butchered bodies, like, in the forest, and everyone knows, like, this isn't normal. This doesn't like the people who are fighting don't do this. Nobody here does this. What are we encountering? And then the reveal after what should be the climactic fight for these guys after they've sort of raided this village, the realization now that they are being actively hunted. It all really works well in a way that I think becomes really hard for movies to sustain as they get like franchised. Where increasingly it becomes like, okay, we need to get to the part where, obviously
they move to
now,
the kills faster because what this movie does so well is, and it's rare, especially in horror adjacent, like sci-fi horror, is these are generally smart characters doing smart things, and we learn the rules alongside them. I think the movie's really well paced at you're understanding. you don't have more information than the character. You have a little bit, right? Like you get the heat map, you get a little sense of that's how it's tracking, but you're learning what the characters are learning along with them. And as those rules are defined and create a space of what this creature can and can't do, like that's really fun. And usually, and the movie's not even really obvious about it. Like there's only like one instance when it does, when he, you know, Dust discovers that the mud like seems to make it so he can't see him. And he does utter like, he can't see me. But it's rare. It's otherwise the movie is like pretty good at like, hey, like, we're not going to spell out every bit about what's happening. You're just going to pick up on aesthetically, like how we are framing things. And it makes it a really rewarding movie to watch the first time as you establish that rule set. And on rewatch, it's even more satisfying because you can better appreciate the setups and payoffs. You're like, oh shit, like I didn't fully grasp this is what was doing and what, you know, how that paid off later in the film.
Can I ask, I'm just curious what people made of the squad overall, because I think what's so interesting to me is, like, I mean, at this point I've seen the movie enough now where I'm like, I love all these little bastards. But at the same time, I revisit that helicopter scene a lot. Is like they go out of their way to make this like one of the most cringy and least appealing groups of people that like so you can possibly imagine. And yet also, like, I come away from it feeling like the movie is constantly also towing this line of like who these characters are versus how they present to each other is part of this film. And I'm just curious,
like, masculinity as performance, like, is that entire like helicopter scene.
Did y'all know that Hawkins' girlfriend has a massive fucking puss? Did y'all know?
Billy just staring him down.
Yeah. So fucking funny. The second time it happens where Billy just stares him down until he just gets so awkward that he slowly slinks away, and then Billy's like, oh fuck, that was really good. It's so... It makes me really like Billy's probably my favorite character in this movie. I like his just like I feel like he has a good relationship with everybody. I appreciate his presence. He's a real scene stealer.
It almost felt like the scene that you're supposed to be like, okay, and this is the order they die in, as you count like how kind of asshole-y they each are to each other, which really makes a later moment with Mac and his kind of as Blaine is Blaine the first one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Blaine is the first one to get murked.
Yeah. I mean, he said the slur, so he has to get murked first.
Wait, no, no. It's,
oh, no, what's his face?
Hawkins first. Hawkins goes first. Hawkins goes first. Then yes, Blaine is searching for the thing that killed Hawkins and he gets shot in the chest.
But also, there's a moment with him and Carl Weathers' character, Dylan, I always forget, where I was like, oh, is this guy also racist? Which then they, like, you know, they end up wrapping back around with Mac's character being like, no, actually, they were friends. He just hated that guy because he was part of the CIA. Like, right? Like, he's just, like, being an asshole to Carl Weathers because he's, like, part of a branch of the army that he doesn't like, right? They're, like,
these movies... Right. These movies frequently moralizing as a way to tell you like what's going to happen next with these characters. Especially when you were watching a movie that is just about, well, I'm going to watch these people get butchered. This is a slasher movie with a really cool character design and a lot more characterization going on than you're going to get in your average slasher movie. That is truly just a reason to watch a bunch of teenagers get, you know, murked in different ways. But, I think this movie like has elements of that, right. But part of what makes it smarter or more watchable is that it's not as clear cut A to B that is doing that. It presents that scene that feels like that kind of scene where like, all right, well, I know what the order is going to be once the Predator shows up. And that's just not the case, because I think it's actually, you know, as we've discussed, it's more about establishing the performances these characters do to one another to in many ways show kindness and friendship, but in the only ways that they kind of know how. And if you looking back, I've seen, you know, that the arm wrestling scene is like so iconic in like GIF form and images on the internet. It's one of those things where the multiplied number of people who know what that have seen that clip on the internet but have never seen Predator is probably exponential. Rewatching it, like, it lingers on that initial clasp for a really long time. It's like, so it is long. A full couple of seconds where I thought I, you know, the gifts are sped up, right? They go faster. It's like clap poof, over, and here the camera lingers just long enough for it to feel like a little weird in a way that I appreciated. And it's those sorts of dimensions and depth to the film that it's like, oh, you're doing something here by lingering in a way that, I don't know, like is a through line for the rest of the film.
Well, and also, like, so that grip is so, and this is how you know this relationship is bad. They immediately, like, Dutch and Dylan are immediately, like, in a battle in some ways for dominance of like, and obviously it's Schwarzenegger coming off his, like, the tail end of his bodybuilding era. He's gonna win no matter how thick Carl Weathers is at this moment. But, like, but it contrasts with the fact that, like, all the little challenges you see guys giving each other on the helicopters are also these weird, like, fucked up expressions of affection, right? Like the dude who checks, he whips the thing at, God, is it Hawkins? The nerd with the glasses.
He whips the thing
at him, and the guy sort of snatches it out of midair and slowly, like, smirk at each other, right? It's all these ways of, like, checking, you good. You got Blaine offering everybody his shitty chaw, right? And nobody wants it, but it is his way of being like, we all want this chaw, right? And by the way, I'm not gay. Hey, just so you, just so everyone knows, I'm not gay.
Bunch of slurs.
There's absolutely nothing, like, I'm not in love with Mac. What are you talking about? What?
Who said that?
Yeah, exactly. So, like,
hey, that guy's gay, actually. Whoever says that, that's the fucking gay one.
but I think it's like, it sort of draws this distinction, like, immediately, whereas, like, Dutch and Dylan are friendly, but immediately there's this undercurrent of, like, the one trying to, like, control the other. And then within the squad, you've got these, like, really awkward, like, bonding rituals, like, playing out, which are partly about, like, testing each other, but they're also partly about, like, it is the only way they know how to check in on each other as well.
Yeah, you can't say how you're doing. You have to have a goofy bit in order to accomplish it. And it's stuff like this that makes the moments where the characters start to crack to be profoundly satisfying. And, like, that is no better exemplified than by Mac, who, you know, just his face is, you know, just stone. Like, it's expressive, but in a, you know, only when he chooses to be. And so as the movie goes on and more of them are being taken out, and right before he goes, where he is just sort of, I mean, he is just sweating. Like, he is losing it. Like, it makes it really effective when it's like, all right, well, if Mac's losing it, then it makes it much more impactful than, you know, your traditional sort of characters that end up in a story like this, where of course they're going to be spooked, but they're able to probably fall back on that code, right? It's partly performance, it's partly code. It's an operating structure to make it through a sequence where you sort of disassociate to some degree. Well, we're just doing this because this is the job. These are my skills. And then part of what the Predator does is break that sequence. It's like, okay, now what? And then they're sort of like, that inability to connect is sort of like revealed by the fact that the Predator strips away all of the veneer. It's like, no, nothing that you know is operable here. Nothing of this is going to help you. You're probably all going to die. And you can't help but be scared because that's literally all that you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember, but I just had a question. Are they as profligate with the ammo when they're raiding the village as in the scene? Because, like, the scene where they crack is obviously them just unloading into the bush.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, they are. Every single time. If someone gets shot in this movie, they get shot 8 times. Yeah. that is what is happening. Also, the thing I found interesting here in comparison to, like, modern action films is, like, this movie feels like it utterly rejects precision. Like people are not cool because they are capable or precise. They are cool because they can carry the big guns and hold the trigger for a really long time.
Until the end, though, right? Like, this movie is split into two halves where it is that movie, as you were suggesting, thematically and like aesthetically, and then the only way to survive is to actually be, you know, to have a 10-minute preparation sequence with Dutch where he is being as precise as you could be in order to create a potentially, you know, survivable situation for himself. Let's take a quick break, and then we will touch on some questions.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. Ren, you said you wanted to bring something up quick.
I found the one-liners in this movie kind of fascinating because of how fucking weird and awkward they feel in comparison to everything else. They come kind of out of nowhere, and the camera lingers. It feels like every single time someone does a one-liner in this movie, it feels like the camera lingers on it in the same way it lingers on the clasping hands for like 3 seconds too long to be comfortable. I think about the when Dutch stabs the guy and like impales him to a wall, and he goes, stick around, and then just keeps moving in a way that like there's not another act of violence in that movie that feels like him stabbing someone and going, stick around, and then the camera holds for a second too long and then keeps going. And I find that really, really fascinating.
Did they do, how many other action stars got that treatment? Do you remember from the, so Ren, like if you go back, if you just were to search on YouTube for like commando one-liners, like this is, there was a, this is something that Schwarzenegger did in a lot of his films in which the camera would linger as he spit out a one-liner. They clearly they've written 100 of them on set. They film all of them and then they just like pick the best ones and put it in the film. And Predator is a movie that has a handful of them, but there are other movies like Commando, which is essentially a movie built around him doing one-liners in between action sequences. But was that exclusive to Schwarzenegger, or was that more just like an 80s action movie thing? I don't have a precise.
I feel like it's a thing that I associate the most with Schwarzenegger for sure. Like at least the ones that I could that come to mind, all his movies.
Part of it because you got directors trying to like navigate the fact that throughout the 80s, his like skills as an actor and English speaker are just much shakier, right?
Yeah.
And like they can get away with it in Terminator because, you know, as he even sort of admitted with his accent and the way he spoke English, there was kind of an unnatural precision and rhythm to it that like fit the character really well. But in a lot of, so much of this other stuff, it's like, I guess we throw quips at him and like try to make it stick. But I also remember it just being a quippier era. But I think that's in part because like the action comedy is more of a thing in this era as well.
Mm-hmm. This is like, this is like, you know, Beverly Hills Cop and where like the action comedy mashup is like one of the more popular genres at the box office.
Big Trouble in Little China was around this time, wasn't it?
Am I allowed to admit that I've never seen that movie, which is like, doesn't make any sense. I know.
It's okay. I only saw it like last week. Like, I don't know. It was like, what, 3 weeks ago? 4 weeks ago?
I claim to be a Carpenter fan. But I've not watched it because I thought at one point maybe we would watch it for something on here. It would be fun to talk about having never seen it before.
We can all look. I think, Patrick,
how do I make a connection from Prey to the Big Trouble in Little China?
go do some IMDb searching, Kato.
You need to have the experience I did of getting super hyped about this movie that everyone's like built up in your head, and then you watch it and you're like, oh.
See, that's what I'm worried about. It's one of the reasons I've never watched it, Rob, is because I saw all the other Carpenter stuff at young enough that, like, I knew they were good or had heard they were good, was still able to approach them on their own terms and find a lot of enjoyment in it. And then the problem is I've waited too long now. Now it's like, it's maybe is it better that I never see it and I can just keep let that be a long running bit for myself, as opposed to having your experience, which I feel is like more likely, which is to see it and go, oh, well, the stuff that I just kind of picked up on over the years, like, I guess I could have just left it there instead of seeing the movie. But I'm terrified of break. It's like going back to playing an old video game. Like, oh, shit, that wasn't it. That's not very good anymore. But I don't know.
It is a movie with exactly the relationship to race that you would expect it to have, and also a totally different relationship to race than you would expect it to have. It is a disorienting movie in many ways.
It's also somehow every video game ever after that movie stole something from that movie.
Yep. Oh, the impact that movie had.
Yep. Yep.
Is
wild.
It's unbelievably huge. This question was related to some stuff we were talking about before. This comes in from, so, hi, I'm Bree, they, them, friends and I, all homosexuals, watched Predator the other night and agreed that this is what camp is for straight men, as in the mode / aesthetic, not the outdoor activity. Thoughts?
Yes. Yes. What? This movie's total camp. Yes. Yes. All the awkward pauses, all of the one-liners, like, yes, 1,000%. This is camp for straight men.
And, like, it's got that ironic twist of it, too, right? Like, there's...
Right.
Because it's not taking the action totally seriously, right? Like, we've talked about before, like, something about the way that those action scenes play out is like, this is about a technological might that then gets subverted by the alien later on. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. It's playing with gender in the same way, in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
That I find very entertaining. Rob, looks like you have thoughts.
No, it's just, I think the one area is that McTiernan might make movies that are too good to be pure, like, to be, like, totally camp. Like, I think the problem is this thing can, like, wink. This thing winks and nods a lot at what it is doing. But it is not a film I would go so far as to call, like, camp. But I think that might be because, like, there's, like, traditions of B pictures that this thing is, like, right on the border of.
I also think that this is slightly underselling camp as like the social utility of camp in art, where like I think that camp generally has a slightly negative association with it of like frivolity, because of its playfulness, right? It is an inherently playful thing, and I think it is often associated with like frivolity, but I think it can also make very sharp criticisms. Mm-hmm. and very prescient ones, and I think that like for me Predator manages to be that kind of camp that is not just like winking and nodding, but is like actually trying to have a conversation through that irony.
I think, but like the one thing I'll say is, if I think about the versions of this that get really campy, I think about like where the Rambo series ends up. And I'm like, uh-oh, Sly, you're making camp now. It's become camp. And so I think that's the one place I agree with everything you just said there, but I'm also, I do kind of wonder if in the context of that time, mm-hmm. you saw what like was being, what sort of was being extruded Hollywood.
This is taking a high concept genre exercise and taking it really seriously. So I think it exudes, I don't think the camp comparison or description is necessarily wrong, but to Rob's point of relative to other movies that were coming out, or television that was coming out in the era, this is like a very serious take on a high concept idea. And so
I guess the one thing I might also, but my cop to here though, is that we say that now because by this point we know this is a classic and like definitive of the genre, much like Die Hard will be a year later, but both of them might be to a degree exercises in camp that were just so well executed that like their reputation just grows into becoming like classic cinema. Because if you look at Die Hard too, it's like this motherfucker just does not stop like quipping through this entire adventure. He blows up an entire building. And then we cut to like the dumb police chief being a dipshit. So we get I don't know. It's like I think it's a great frame to put on this film. It just gets tougher to judge context for these things to some extent, in part because the industry has changed so much since then. It's harder to, you know, like when we were naming like the action comedy, right? And like Patrick, you cited Beverly Hills Cop. I was actually thinking the same thing, but didn't feel quite precise. And the problem is none of us remember the bog standard genre exercises from this era,
those are the movies that are elevated as classics, and the rest are just they just littered the, you know, the video store that you went to, and it's like, well, I've seen Beverly Hills Cop 25 times. I don't know. I'll get the one that's next to it that looks, you know, whatever the low rent version of that
is. Oh no, Beverly Hills Cop 3 was the only one here. Ah! And then you turn into the guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. How do you end up watching Predator 2, you know, 7 or 8 times? It's because, well, Predator was rented out and they also made a Predator 2. Predator 2 has it's a bad movie, but it has
Austin Walker. I don't want to put words. He has defended it to me. And
It can be defended. Yeah. There are lots of, and that is actually kind of Predator 2 is where the AVP connection comes from. Fox owned Predator and Alien. And at the end of Predator 2, when Danny Glover has proven that he is a worthy warrior to the Predator tribe, he looks in the spaceship and there is a skull of a xenomorph in there. And then that leads to it is one of the all time. Like crossovers didn't happen. That's not a thing that was comics only.
Right.
That is like a huge part of why Predator 2 is believed to be. I mean, again, it can be defended, but like that ending bit is like sticks out really far in people's brains because it was incredible to have been suggested that these characters could exist in the same universe. And then when it became much of comics and eventually became movies decades later. But one of these really interesting, this will be probably something we talk about more in Prey, and especially some of the conversation around Prey. And I'm not going to spoil anything about that film. But part of what makes Predator interesting and such an interesting revisit is because in the same way we're having the discussion of like, what is it? How does this movie feel separated from the context of when it came out? How does it feel looking at that and like from a 2022 lens and what it's doing with genre? Is that if you were, I think most people's memories of Predator involve none of what we're talking about, right? Like it is nothing about like masculinity. Like I only read about that stuff. It wasn't until revisiting the film that it becomes so obvious to me upon rewatch. I do not think that's like, if you were just coming to this as a kid watching it, it operates just as like a big bombastic, like killer, like creature feature. And so I think for a lot of people, what has made the conversation around Prey, a movie that does some interesting things with like these specific traits that we're talking about in terms of how much it forwards it rather than kind of backgrounding it, and making that sort of like core to the experience of watching it. Predator is a movie that I think for a lot of people, they categorize it. It may be one of their favorite movies, Rob, but it still just sits as like a big bombastic action movie in which Schwarzenegger kills an alien at the end. Not necessarily a movie they consider to be like an interesting exercise in like themes, which is something that I've only really come to appreciate as I've gotten older and revisited it and even had the language to watch the movie from that direction. Let's see. Do you think this comes in from somebody else? Unfortunately, I don't have names attached to this because it came from a Google form. Do you think the firefight with the gorillas at the beginning is deliberately kind of bad and massively over the top to lure audiences into a false sense of security and give them a false impression of what kind of movie it is? I love a good 80s action movie, but the shootout has no sense of spatial geography. It consists mostly of stuntmen jumping off of platforms. Do you think this was deliberate, or do you think McTiernan and company really thought it was awesome? Or do you think the scene is actually just straight up good?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned earlier that I feel like the amount of bombast there is meant to like directly contrast with how much all of that bombast is not going to help them in the end, right? Like the amount of firepower they have and the way they show it off there is like ridiculous in a lot of ways. And then
there is so many scenes of like, it's incredible. Like, I was having a beer. I was like, I'm just gonna take a sip every time two characters are shot across the screen in the air.
Here's the thing about that scene that makes me fall on the it's intentional side. How does the attack in the guerrilla camp, like, how do they, how, what is the first thing we see of the guerrilla camp? We see a dude executed.
The murder? Yeah.
Yeah, we see a dude executed, and the film does not shy away from the fact that it is an execution. It is one of the most startling and discongruous acts of violence in this entire movie, because everything else has this sense of bombast to it, or this, like, you know, this the sci-fi lens, right? You have heads exploding, blah, 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 blah. At the beginning of this movie, a man gets shot in the head. And the film understands what it means for someone to be shot in the head. And then the preceding scene is, is just a bunch of dudes firing as many bullets as possible.
Dudes rock.
Chests as possible.
Give a gun.
Dudes rock.
Well, and that the cut right after the execution, it cuts to Dutch. And you can tell that it has impacted him, right? Like Schwarzenegger has a sort of like look on his face of not just like anger, but like he was disturbed at what he had just seen. And like the camera lingers on that for a moment before it then moves into the action scene itself. And I think that definitely that reinforces the point you're making. The movie understands the different levels of violence that it's depicting and why and when it chooses to show it.
And I think it almost mirrors at the very end of the movie where Dutch picks up the rock and he's going to go smash the predator's head in. And then he looks at it and he's like, fuck. And he just doesn't. And then it leads to the predator, you know, blowing itself up in a nuclear explosion. But I do find there are moments where characters are given the opportunity to do things that I think the audience would associate with real violence. Shooting someone in the head, smashing someone's head with a rock versus like blowing a guy up with a laser gun. And I find it very interesting that at the moment where Dutch is offered real violence, he rejects it. After seeing the execution, I think it kind of recolors the guerrilla fight for me. But also, you know, it makes it feel like the guerrilla fight is not treating those characters as human. Those characters are not treated as real people in the same way that the dude being executed on the ground is a real person, or Mac and Dutch are real people. And I think that does, like, it feels uncomfortable in a way that I wonder if it could be intentional.
I think something I just had to look up because I want to make sure that context was correct around this to some extent. So, the second Rambo movie comes out in 85. And I think that's
how far is that from the first one? What's the distance?
I want to say that might be like 6 years, honestly. But
that would make
question.
Some sense,
yeah,
because
the
Rambo 2 is when it becomes an action film as opposed to like a character study of like PTSD.
Right. Sorry, yeah. So First Blood is 82. And then Rambo First Blood Part 2 comes out in 85.
Okay.
And that is the one where he goes and wins Vietnam. After the fact.
It's that series is fucking
and it is that kind of movie, by the way. It's like it's all the attack on the rebel camp in that movie. Is just like this kind of action. And so I think like McTiernan in this scene is shooting a scene from a different type of movies where these dudes are usually the triumphant heroes. And they get their little triumph, and that is not the end of this picture. And I think, to me, it has always felt intentional that he shoots the kind of like, oh man, there's just a lot of bad brown people in this fucking village, and we gotta smoke them. And he shoots that scene, and then the rest of the film is like watching these guys get obliterated and hunted down. In like the most cold-blooded fashion possible. So I've always sort of felt like the attack on the rebel camp is like very intentionally mirroring a lot of like action and war movie tropes. that Predator is in dialogue with and is in the process of subverting. Mm-hmm.
And also, like, the immediate, like, almost immediate fallout of it is, like, shit, we weren't, this isn't the sort of stuff we're supposed to do, right? There's barely a moment of, like, triumphant, like, celebration at all, except from, like, for a bit, you get an exclamation from Carl Weathers' character being like, there's so much more here than I thought we would get. Like, there's so much more intel, but that's the only thing. Everyone else is, and especially Dutch, is all, like, immediately, like, what, this, something was wrong here, right? Even though during the scene itself, it's very much like, look at how big we can make these explosions and how many people we can set on fire simultaneously.
One thing I wanted to zero in on that I definitely had not internalized until this rewatch was the movie goes almost 30 minutes without any dialogue. It becomes essentially, it's not a silent movie, but it is a movie in which everything is communicated through the actions of Dutch, what the Predator is or isn't doing. And it's not quite 30 minutes, but it's pretty close. Mm-hmm. And it's really only punctuated by the presence of a really kind of unnecessary one-liner, like, you're one ugly motherfucker, I think is one of them. It's a funny line. His execution is fun, but it sort of pierces this, like, otherwise really, like, just does not exist in these movies. Like, it is just a really long sequence in which you are watching two people prepare, like, do the preparatory montage, but, you know, done over the course of roughly 30 minutes, because even once the action kicks into gear, there's no reason for Dutch to speak to this thing. And we don't know if this creature can speak back anyway. And I just found that extraordinary as an exercise to have the film be that quiet, even when it's being loud.
Yeah, I think that if you total the amount of time in this film that is silent, I actually think you, like, where no one is speaking, I think you actually get closer to, like, 50 minutes, because it's not just the fight with the Predator at the end. There are, like, long segments of this film where people are just walking through terrain awkwardly, too. I think that is the other, like, thing that I find really interesting about these, like, what the film is doing with location and with the idea that we aren't supposed to be doing this. These guys are bad at moving through this space. Like, there are points where they are very awkwardly, like, actors are very clearly stumbling over plants in the, like, plants and rocks in the environment in a way that feels, if it wanted to portray these characters as perfectly competent, it would not show them stumbling over rocks every 35 seconds while still trying to keep up the appearance of competence. Mm. Because, like, they have all these hand signals and they're like, oh, go forward. None of that shit matters or pays off. And it's just a bunch of dudes quietly bumbling around an environment they have no familiarity with.
It's funny that works thematically for the movie, because in reading about the production, it was largely because they just kept... they couldn't walk straight in the environment they were shooting in. Apparently, famously, this was, like, such a nightmare for the person in that ultimately, like, went into the Predator suit. They couldn't see out of it. And so I guess there was one scene when the Predator is beating the shit out of Dutch, in which they couldn't really rehearse the fights because he just couldn't see anything inside the suit. And one time he messed up the order of swings, which were much more critical because he couldn't see, and just took, like, the big metal, like, I don't know what you call that, was on one of his arms, like, and just fucking bashes Schwarzenegger in the head with it. And they would have, like, the rehearsals were him having to memorize where all the rocks were, because then when he had to actually do it on camera, and it's why there's so many cuts during those sequences, because, like, otherwise it's just a lot of footage of this giant person slipping and falling. They only do it a couple times in the movie, but there are a couple of sequences where you see the Predator kind of, like, jumping between rocks, and it's sort of doing it in a, I don't know, like a little, like, fancy and free, like,
sprightly.
Sprightly, yes.
And it would crack, and it was clearly in slow motion because they didn't have that many shots of it. But every time they did it, it's so diametrically opposed to the way it's presented as, like, otherwise a kind of Terminator that it's going to slowly, like, encroach upon you in a close shot. But when it's off kind of doing its own thing, it's like, dee-dee-dee, dee-dee-dee. So, and it made me laugh every time.
It reminds me a bit of, like, it's the Jaws thing, right? Where mm-hmm. the conception of how this is going to work involves a much more active antagonist that you can, like, see doing stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the process, it just proves so unworkable that they end up probably making a more memorable movie because of it. Like, yes. For me, the most memorable, like, these guys sort of dialing in on, like, what they're up against is, I think it's Mac who realizes that, like, he sees the visual disturbance in the trees.
Mm-hmm. It's Mac showing it to Dylan. Yeah, where he points it out.
Yeah, and Bill Duke is so still, like, because he recognizes now that, like, we can't spook it. Like, we, like, just don't, like, like, you know, everyone play cool, but it is up there. And so, like, we get this idea of the Predator as being this, like, really still, watchful, terrifying opponent because it is so deliberate, because it is such a silent, patient observer. And you probably don't get that characterization, that idea of what the Predator, like, being a Predator, you know, what makes it so scary. You probably don't get that as much if the original concept had worked out well, where, like, all that composite shooting we're going to work out, and the Predator suit we're going to be a bigger part of this. Instead, by, like, sort of shooting around the absence of the Predator as an active antagonist, you end up being, again, like, much more psychologically effective, as effectively these guys feel like they are at war with the jungle itself.
Mm-hmm. I want to read how they achieve the invisibility effect, because this comes at a really interesting period in which, you know, we are before, like, visual effects computers are like really interacting with films of this scale. The invisibility effect is achieved by having someone wear a bright red suit, because with the farthest opposite of the green of the jungle and the blue of the sky, the size of the Predator, the red was removed with chroma key techniques, leaving an empty area. The take was then repeated without the actors, using a 30% wider lens on the camera. When the two takes were combined optically, the jungle from the second take filled in the empty area. Because the second take was filmed with a wider lens, a vague outline of the alien could be seen with the background scenery bending around its shape. Which, all that shit done with CG now, and it's fine. And so, you know, it's a little cheesy, but it's just, it's so fucking cool how they achieve that. Apparently, like, a bunch of the sparks that happen during a lot of the sequences where the Predator is shooting things were, those are not on set. Those were rotoscoped. Like, those were put onto the film later and are just not present in the scene, which is wild. Like, because it looks so good. It's the kind gorgeous. Of stuff that it's gorgeous and feels real, even if it's quote unquote fake or in many ways it is acting similarly to how CG effects work. But whereas our brains can recognize so quickly CG effects, if you watch enough of those films, I'm always jealous of folks like my wife who are like, well, doesn't that look like computers? And she's like, no. I'm like, oh, my brain is broken. Like, I can see, I've seen too much of this. And there's something about it's part of why I love this era of filmmaking before you could even do anything like this, because you can have sequences that they can trick you. Like, I know it's fake, but, like, I buy the reality of it because the techniques used just make an imprint differently than the way computers are used now.
I just feel like I have fully realized that, like, there's sometimes I'm like, yep, these are effect shots, but there's also a ton of, like, composite effect shots that I just no longer can see. Like, when you actually see how extensively and trivially they're used, like, even on sitcoms where it's like, oh, you know that, like, office they're in? Yeah, that's not a real set. And I'm like, what? There's no office. It's like, no.
We filmed at nighttime, and then just changed the backgrounds to the day.
That stuff that, like, so like, I definitely am not one of those folks who, like, I'm more paranoid about it than I'm actually confident that I'm identifying effect shots. But I think for me, it's more what I miss is location shooting. Yeah, I think it is the fact that they're actually out in a jungle, like, gives it a really distinctive character. And, like, when we get that culminating fight at night, like, that thing is lit up like the bridge scene in Apocalypse Now, right? Like, it's all, like, phosphorus flares and, like, smoke on the water and, like, the mud glistening against, like, the eerie light of the flares. All that shit is amazing. And, like, I think it is partly because, like, the filmmakers are having to figure out how do we split this night and shoot this scene and make it legible. And you end up with a really remarkable denouement where not that much happens, but it just feels like a lot of shit is happening because of the way it's shot.
You have to put the guys in the place. The way that you got to make a movie, you got to take some weird guys and you got to put them in a place. And if you do that, a movie spontaneously emerges. If you get enough weird guys and put them in a place. This is my theory of film.
It is. I agree, Rob. I think, like, you can, even if there are elements of this film, I don't know what the split is between, like, whether they had to do any pickups on sets that were dressed to look like a jungle. I don't know. But it's a testament to enough of the on location stuff that you can't know. And I was reading that, I guess, you know, obviously they portray this movie as, damn, it's sweaty out there. Like, they're just melting. This movie was freezing. They had heat lamps all over the set.
Wait, what?
At all times. Yes. Yeah.
The jungle was cold?
The jungle was cold. Now, this might have been exclusively the night scenes. Like when they were doing, like the sequences where Dutch is in the mud, man, apparently went on for 3 weeks. And he is just frozen in mud. Like the shooting of, you know, I think you can feel. And this is like a, you know, maybe this is a bullshit, you know, older person thing. Although Ren just articulated a point that I feel like backs it all up and makes me feel better about it. But I feel like you can look. I think actors should be treated well. They should feel safe on set. But this movie was grueling to make to some degree, physically, and taxing on the actors. And I think you can feel it in the movie. I think it's part of its enduring quality. Like, I think it, like, you feel it in the you feel it in the scenes. You feel it in sequences. Like, it is being on set. And it is working with practical things, and it is the fact that it was a pain in the ass to shoot, I think is part of what, it's a lot of things that add up to a thing, but I don't think you can, I don't think you can separate that part from part of what makes this movie hold up this many years later.
Patrick's really glad all those PAs had to carry the boat from Fitzcarraldo through the jungle.
Oh my God.
Well, they shipped a bunch of Schwarzenegger's, I guess the cast would get up in the middle. They would get up at 4 a.m. and work out before they shot. Mm-hmm. And like Schwarzenegger had a bunch of his like personal stuff flown out. So I guess I'm just presuming. I don't know where that stuff was on set. But
can you imagine? Oh my God, this has to be one of the all time most like Do You Even Lift, Bro set like shoots in history. God. Just all these dudes going out at dawn to just like make gains.
I guess except Shane Black out there, like the two, like the skinny nerdy types, are they also going out?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. They're doing extra. Yes. 100%. Again, this is my fucking, you have to put the weird guys in a place theory of film. These dudes have to be in a place to get good chemistry. Like, they have to be in the same room for a lot of time doing annoying, dumb shit while all the PAs are off doing, like, work. These guys have to be, like, fucking around with weights.
It's 4:30 in the morning. You're Shane Black in a cold, high-altitude jungle. Arnold Schwarzenegger is encouraging you to get in there on those weights, and begins delivering the "it feels like coming" monologue when he talks
He's also handing you 3 cigars, and you're actually gonna have to smoke these while you're lifting the weights.
God, I want to see now that I mentioned Fitzcarraldo. I want to see the Werner Herzog documentary about the making of Predator.
Oh, and so you see the men lifting in the jungle. They bring their objects here, and it represents our inability to recognize what is in front of us.
I would watch that. I bet the behind the scenes stuff on this movie is good. How's Mina, Rob? You got so animated a second
ago.
She's
great. She had to come running in, say hello, and then run away as I try to pet her, and then run back at me so I can try to pet her, and then she has to run. She'll start barking in a second.
Certified Mina moment.
Yep.
Question. What do you think the predators eat? Are the mandibles functional for eating, or vestigial?
I think, I think that they use them to like, I think they'd like bugs. I think they're like bugs. They do a little juice and then they go, and they like slurp it. You know?
I was getting a strong protein shake and smoothie vibe from the entitomyces at this point. So I think like to a degree there's some like physiological issues they have with other sorts of food, but also I think just intellectually now, it's like this has all the nutrients I need to again make these gains.
I agree. Man, when the predator does, when they reveal that it has like a recording box and it loops back the Billy laugh from earlier in the film. I don't think I realized that's what that was until this viewing.
It's heinous.
Because they just hold on to that being a feature of the Predator until the last possible moment to give it the most possible impact.
I thought they have him doing it a bunch. He does it a bunch of times actually.
Well, does he?
Well, he makes the.
Or do we? Are we supposed to assume he does? Because it seems like he does during that one scene where Mac is actually calling out to Carl Weathers, Dylan.
Yes.
Right. And then at that point, I was like, "Oh shit! Is that the Predator?" Because you hear the playback happen when he's saying those words the first time, and so I'm like, "That's what I thought was happening in that scene." And it ends up actually Mac is there trying to get him to come over. But they like primed that in a way where I was trying to listen for it more often. Mm. And I think
in the script, one of them is that anytime the Predator goes anytime to, he is luring people with the other voice lines. Uh-huh. He starts doing it. I think the first time he does it is the laugh isn't the first thing that he records and plays back. He has a couple of things, but that is the one where it becomes obvious to the characters what is happening.
Right. I guess that's what I should say is that is when it is one of the layered parts of the film where even on this time I didn't really pick up on that being something that was happening until it shoves it in your face. Yeah. And it's just such a it's such a creepy moment.
Yeah, they prime it during the scorpion scene because you hear the people talking and then he plays it back to himself. And it's turn around. Mm. The words are very like directional. And I'm like, someone's going to get fucked up by this.
Well, and I also feel like when the revelation is made to us that that's happening, to me, it always feels a bit like, there's defilement happening as well, right? Yeah. That it's like, and I think it goes to this notion of like that uncomfortable feeling we have earlier of like these guys mow down a bunch of people as if they are not people. And the Predator, like, and to the point that, you know, we were making earlier about like, it's like hierarchies of predator and prey relationships throughout this. You know, the scorpion is a predator at its level of the ecosystem, but also just something to be like squished by someone else. But the fact that the Predator uses these, and these are just your dumb animal noises, the things that make you human, the things that like, right, are you trying to communicate and try to like express yourself to your fellows, these are just the bleats and like groans that the Predator hears you make and knows to use as
a fucking duck call. That was exactly what I was going to say. He's using a duck call on humans.
But I think it also, the thing is, one of the interesting things about this is that as these dudes are subjected to this, they all undergo this process, or at least the ones who are like making it later into the film, of also being stripped away of artifice and being stripped away of these pretenses of being like apex predator soldiers and everything. And so it begins like, you know, by the end you find Billy who just realizes like, we're not getting out of this, but also if he's going to go out, he is going to discard this idea of himself as like a member of the squad, right? He is going to go fight single combat, hand to hand, you know, out on this bridge. And ultimately that's kind of what Dutch ends up having to do as well, is like the Predator sort of is sort of stripping them of their humanity, is stripping them of this idea of like where they sit in the world. But at the same time, as a byproduct of that process, they also start discarding artifice and they start getting down. Like you could argue that they begin reclaiming a more like basic sense of humanity, of like, what may, like, who am I when we boil it all down to essentials? What can I do as a person?
That's Mac's monologue to the sky, is him being stripped down to, at your core, what is the relationship that you had to this other character? And it's him, like, it's the scene where he goes, where Dutch is like, oh, I'm sorry about the, he was a good soldier. And Mac is like, no, fuck that. He was a friend of mine. And like, it is those moments of dropping the artifice that I think are the real strength of the movie. I think you're right, Rob.
But also that sequence with the scorpion, I mean, it also lays sort of the groundwork thematically of like, well, yeah, I mean, you just got to step on it. But if you aren't paying attention, I mean, that scorpion will get you. It can't get you. And that's essentially like Dutch becomes the scorpion. It's like, all right, I'm not really equipped for this, but one shot, if I get one moment, you know, and if the predator is arrogant, and in that case, it could be the human versus scorpion. It could be this, you know, the alien versus Dutch. But it essentially catches the predator can't do a monologue, but when it does the slow Jason Voorhees approach,
yep,
as like, I'm approaching, you ain't going anywhere. Like, I'm coming over to claim, you know, because this is just after he has put him up against the tree stump and is examining his skull.
Yeah.
To say, is this skull worthy? Is this better than, I had a human skull. That's my trophy. But maybe this one is better. Maybe this one is more worthy of me bringing back for my trophy case. And, you know, he essentially does the villain monologue, and that ends up being the thing that gets him in the end. I think it's really interesting.
He takes off the weighted training, like, he takes off his weighted training clothes. Literally, he fucking removes his gun and is like, we are going to stab each other to death in these woods.
And then just kicks the shit out of him. Dutch doesn't get, I mean, it's just, it is, to some degree, it is all just the predator in search of anything that will challenge it. But really, I mean, it knows that it's going to beat the shit out of, out of Dutch. It's just artifice.
And the artificial aspect of the predator's hunt, I find really interesting. It's personal rules about who gets to die and who is a threat and who is a piece of prey is really interesting. There's that moment where it's actually one of the moments where I actually like Dutch as a character a lot. Not just if I find him charming, but I'm like, oh, Dutch is a good guy. And I like when he's on screen is when Anna picks up a gun and he's like, put that shit down immediately. Because the second you have a weapon for an extended period of time, the predator recognizes you as a threat. Even if you are disarmed, if you have a weapon at a point in time, the predator decides, okay, you are fair game.
You're on my shit list.
right, you're on my shit list. And him knocking the gun out of her hands, I think, is a good... See, I also think it's really interesting that, like, Anna is the first person... Because she discards the artifice immediately. Like, she never has artifice, I think, in this film, other than, like, the notion that the film implies that she can't speak English for a significant portion. Like, that is her only artifice. But she is the person who sees the predator first, recognizes what it is they are dealing with, and it is immediately like, nah, this ain't it. This ain't our spot. We do not need this. And I find that really interesting. The fact that, like, one, she survives the movie. The movie does not actively imperil her all that much. And three, I mean, this could be my a misreading of the time. I expected the threat of, like, gendered or sexual violence this entire movie. It was, like, hanging in the air above the character in a way that, like, was worrying for me, and the fact that it never happens was really surprising.
I don't think that's an unfair, even if it was nothing explicitly happened, having a character essentially harass her.
There was
especially
no
even some of the jokes that are set up earlier, it would not have been, that would not be out of character even for this movie. For
no one says
like
she's hot. No one like makes any like that's the like when she appears on screen, I'm like, oh, she's gonna have a thing. Oh, she's gonna get converted by Dutch's hot bod, and that never happens. Like,
then she won't be a commie just... anymore. That, and that's how we won the juntas.
They sent over a bunch of beefy boys.
Send Chad company immediately.
Oh. It's a rescue op.
Operation, rescue op. Operation Beefcake.
I think Anna's positioning is interesting here too, because like there is the there's a lot of, I think to a degree, like she's also trying to assess the danger she's in from these guys versus the danger she's in from the Predator. I think Anna's a character who like is, until it like is truly clear, it is like all humans versus the Predator. She is still very much just playing it like she's between two fires, basically, and is trying to navigate them. And then it's like once it is time to commit to this notion of, we kind of got to figure out what we're going to do about this Predator thing, or nobody's making it out of here. Some of the facade drops, but at the same time, we do learn a lot about the rules.
Right. Her threat assessment is she's got solid threats, because the second she puts hands on one of those dudes, the Predator sees her as a threat. Like, that's the thing, is that she never does real violence throughout the movie, and that is, again, part of why I think the Predator doesn't fuck with her, is because even if she, like, hits one of them, Dunsky. It's Dunsky for her immediately. All bets are off. Kato, you were saying?
Well, I was saying, like, when Rob mentioned between two fires, and just like that kind of also just really works for the very kind of obvious Cold War metaphor happening here, right? Like, it is, you know, people of Central and Southern America between the fucking Russian and US military superpowers, right? Like, those two just like technologically advanced, like superpowers kind of warring, like doing a proxy war on their turf, and like locals being caught in between, right? Like, that kind of really further brought to home this thing, which I had missed the first time I watched it, you know, a decade ago or whatever, that it really was kind of interested in like position, like the way that, you know, Dutch's group is positioned as outsiders crossing a border that they shouldn't be crossing, and then the alien obviously as an outside force to the whole world, being kind of, but still having that same positionality of like being able to cross that border because they're so technologically advanced, over they have the firepower, they have the ammunition, and just like the way that that plays out is, you know, is one of the more interesting parts of this film, honestly. And also the mirrors, which I feel like we've kind of touched on a little, but the way that specifically the one big scene where the alien starts firing blindly into the jungle, the same way the entire group of people is firing blindly into the jungle early on, trying to hit the fucking Predator the first time around, is just a real, I think this film really enjoyed drawing those through lines, and I've heard that Prey works with a lot of these, so I'm excited for that.
The only thing I will say is, a lot of the things that people like about this movie, what if someone took that conversation and then made a whole film about it?
Sick.
I'm very excited.
Prey rips. And it's also an instance in which that sequence in particular, where the Predator is just spraying, is, it, you know, its own code gets stripped away, right? Mm-hmm. And then it doesn't know what to do, and it panics. Like, it's, I don't know if it's scared, but it's panicking at the very least. And earlier, I love that moment when it, you know, when they it screams in the middle of the jungle. It actually, for lack of a better term, like, humanizes the alien to a certain degree, that is more than just, oh, well, if it bleeds, it can be killed. Right. It's that, oh no, like, it can experience pain, which means it can experience fear, which means it can experience anxiety. And like, that is useful for the audience to know, but is also, I don't know, like, makes the creature, there's something about this relative to, you know, its contemporary, an alien, which is, the alien is just an animal, right? Like, it is just, you know, it is not as calculating as the Predator. And the more intelligence that is given to the Predator over the course of the film makes it a more interesting villain relative to how most of these creature features work, which is just it's a disembodied something
right.
wielding a weapon, and we'll see how they get killed. The fact that it has all those characteristics just makes it way more interesting to watch.
And it, I mean, it also needs a certain amount of like cleverness and willpower to then step in it, so to speak, right? The whole point is that these people come in thinking they're hot shit, and the like everything gets flipped on them, and then it happens again to the Predator at the end, like, and they're trying to make that direct through line that just because you're technologically more powerful doesn't necessarily mean you can walk into any place and have an automatic advantage, right? It's about the hubris of military power, and you know, it's mirroring what happened in Vietnam, basically, right? Like, doesn't fucking matter. Like, people who know the place will find ways to, like, you know.
And like, this notion of, specifically that it is technology.
Yeah.
That, like, it is easy to get crossed up thinking that your technology is you. That the thing technology right. allows you to do means these are things that you can do. And yeah, this is where the Vietnam metaphor is really explicit, right? Whereas, like, this notion that all these guys come in confident because they think it's because they're ultimate warriors, but in large degree it is because they're simply better equipped.
Yeah.
And the Predator is in the same zone where it's like, I just need to hunt the most, like, it is classic big game hunter shit. Like, right. what actual big game hunters do, right? Which is, I'm going to test myself against the most dangerous animals using only my wits and thousands of dollars of equipment and sophisticated fucking lures.
Camo.
And
high,
yeah. And like optics that no animal in nature can match, et cetera, et cetera.
Although
in the minute. Yeah.
Interesting that is just fucking Predator vision too, which I love, which is I spent the whole movie thinking that's surely like part of the technology. But then when he takes it off, it just, the colors are inverted, but he still sees heat. Right.
Well, yeah. That is, that's actually, I think one of the things that I find interesting is that the Predator only comes out during the hottest years. I actually think that it's like when it takes the helmet off, its vision actually gets really fucked up. I think that like the...
Oh, that makes sense.
There's
helmet is like dampening it so that it can still pick out, right, because it's hot out. Yeah.
The environment is... It is not the environment it was built for. So the second it takes its helmet off, it is like, oh, I can't see shit here because it's too hot for my eyes to like adjust. Sorry.
But it lives for that challenge.
A fun note.
Yeah.
But like, I guess the final thing I was just going to say is like when all these things are stripped away... The Predator is as helpless and juvenile in a lot of ways as the guys is hunting, right? And that's why, like, the end of this movie is the most I'm taking my ball and going home type thing, where it's like it's graceless in defeat as well. And so the whole honor code thing goes up to a point where it's like it doesn't want to, you know, it's trying to figure out what's the technical definition of what's a valid like prey creature. But then at the end, when it takes its first L, it's just like, I think we should all die in a tiny nuclear explosion.
Mutually assured discretion.
This sucks, man. This sucks. This is total bullshit.
This isn't how much of my bros back on the ship.
Just,
you know?
You just cover yourself in fucking mud. You're just gonna do that. You hide in mud.
I
was just gonna say really quick that the fact that it's a nuke really kind of sells me on the whole like Cold War metaphor, and like the fact that it tries to go for the mutually assured destruction route is very much like, by the way, if you missed it.
The person I was talking about at the beginning of this podcast is the most I'm taking my ball and going home if this stops going my way person I've ever met. And so his deep love of the Predator as a character is just so much the sweeter. It's just, it brings me so much more joy after this.
Well, I think that covers a lot of the movie. Is there anything else that comes to mind that people wanted to bring up before we land this plane?
I am so stoked for Prey.
So stoked.
Yeah. Yes. The one thing I'll say is about Prey is I was listening to an interview with Dan Trachtenberg. If you haven't seen 10 Cloverfield Lane, also an excellent film, Is the movie he did before this. Really, really good, despite the Cloverfield part of it. It's a really good, smart little thriller with an excellent performance by John.
Are you anti-Cloverfield?
No, I'm pro-Cloverfield, but okay. I think when you say that, people can get the wrong impression. You know what I mean?
Well, there's Cloverfield. Yeah, this is what Cloverfield, I was
going to say. 10 Cloverfield Lane, Cloverfield Paradox. I was pro the Cloververse, and then Cloverfield Paradox fucked it all up. And but I think sometimes people hear that, and they might have a strong impression about Cloverfield as a found footage film. I can see why people wouldn't like that movie. I adore Cloverfield. I think it's great. But it's like a really taut, tight thriller that's worth watching. Anyway, he tells this story on the KingCast. He was on there talking about The Raft from Creepshow 2, and they were talking about Prey, and he was too young to go see Predator in theaters, and so on the school bus, all the older kids were just talking about how sick Predator was. Like, they were, you know, like the middle schoolers, and they were able to go for whatever reason. And they basically spent the entire bus ride describing how all the scenes of Predator and how cool they were. And they described this long sequence that is not present in the film of, oh, and Billy took off all his shit and he walks off and he goes to fight the Predator, and it's sick. And so for a long time, Dan Trachtenberg was like, that sounds like a really cool scene of like this person fighting the Predator one on one. Can't wait to see that in the film. Built it all up in their head. Finally sees Predator. Scene is non-existent. And then so the seed of Prey is, well, I really wanted to see that scene in Predator.
Yes.
I think I'll just go make that movie.
That's amazing.
Glad that Dan Trachtenberg and I had the same idea.
Yes. Prey is excellent. I'm excited for all of us to watch that very soon. Because I think that's gonna do it for this inaugural episode of My Turn. Our thanks to Mellow for our music. If you're listening to this through Waypoint Plus, thank you for your support. If you're listening it through the Waypoint radio feed, if you want to hear these episodes early and without ads, consider subscribing at waypointplus.com. And everyone, please leave a review on iTunes. It really does help new people find the podcast. We made it. We went from 1,600 to 1,700. I checked, crushed it. The march to 1,800. Get on there. Give us some stars. I don't care if they're one stars. The algorithm doesn't give a shit. Just, just stars. All that matters. You can follow my work at Patrick Klubik. Kato, where can people follow you?
At @A_Kato_ appears on Twitter.
Ren?
At Ren or Raven.
And Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
Next week, we'll be watching Prey, which is available on Hulu now if you want to watch it, although criminal that movie did not come out in theaters.
I want to see that, it on a fucking screen.
I know.
Everything people are saying, I'm like, I want to see it on a big screen.
Apparently, because when it's a Fox movie, and when Disney bought Fox, they had existing rights with HBO, and so if they put it out in one theater, it would go to HBO Max first. And so Disney owns Hulu. Anyway, it's bullshit. It's bullshit. You're going to watch this and go, should have seen this on a movie theater. So until then,
I don't have to choose.
Wow.
I see the problem is I have the projector, but I don't have Rob's sound. And so, you know, one day Rob will visit me and we'll have a long conversation where you can convince my wife why I should spend thousands of dollars on a sound system. We'll get there. But to the end, I don't know. I got to come up with a sign off, but we'll see you next week.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.